Texas Parks and Wildlife Podcast, providing an exclusive look into efforts to conserve the wild things and wild places in Texas.
Hello, and welcome to the very first Texas Parks and Wildlife Podcast. I'm Lydia Saldana with Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation. Today, we're talking with Carter Smith, Executive Director of Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. Thanks for being with us today, Carter.
Delighted to do so, Lydia. Thank you so much.
Well, let's get this conversation started with something everyone likes to talk about, the weather. How have the severe storms and flooding we've experienced these past few months impacted the parks and wildlife of Texas?
Well, El Nino definitely showed up. Let me say that. And, you know, that phenomena has been both really good and really bad, depending on where you are in the state. On the positive side, our lakes and reservoirs are at almost record levels, roughly 87-88% capacity across the state. The Highland Lakes are completely full for the first time. Really, most of the state's aquatic systems are doing really well. Lots of water in our creeks and rivers rushing into the bays and estuaries, and that is enormously positive. And similarly, our range conditions and habitat conditions are as good as many of us have seen in decades. And this really represents almost the third spring in which the state's ranches have had their Sunday clothes on. And that portends great things for quail and turkey and deer and songbirds. On the flip side, has come a lot of devastation, particularly in the eastern part of the state. And communities from Deweyville to Houston have suffered immense amounts of flood-related damages. And I'm deeply proud of the role of our state's game wardens have played as first responders. They have rescued and saved hundreds and hundreds of families and lives and pets and livestock, and have just been on the front lines of the state's response to this. And they always shine the brightest when times are the darkest, and I couldn't be more proud of that role that they play in service to our state citizens and the communities. Similarly, as communities across Texas have been adversely affected in places by the flooding, so too have our state parks and wildlife management areas. In 2015 alone, roughly two-thirds of the state parks were either fully or partially closed because of flood-related impacts. And, you know, that includes some of our biggest places like Lake Ray Roberts and Cedar Hill and Somerville and Whitney, and now Brazos Bend State Park. These are immensely popular. We're still evolving in terms of our assessment of the damages to state parks, but you know, right now we expect that to be somewhere in the neighborhood of $40 million of damage to infrastructure. We've also had a lot of damage to our wildlife management areas in East Texas, and we've lost levees and roads and had to cancel public hunts and had damage to other infrastructure. So it's significant. Fortunately, we haven't lost any lives in any of the WMAs or state parks that we steward during these flood events, and I'm proud of our team's response on that front.
Are any of the parks closed because of these damages, Carter?
Yes, we have a number of parks that are closed. One thing that I encourage all of our state park users to do is go to our website, and we have real-time information about the status of openings and closures on state parks. And so you can look up a park of interest to you and determine very quickly whether it's closed or open, and if it's closed, whether it's fully or partially closed. And it's a great resource that, again, is updated in real time to give our park enthusiasts information they need when planning their trips.
Now, of course, we're heading into the busiest time of the year for state parks, and you just talked about some bad news, but the really good news is that the Texas legislature came through for our parks in a big way this past session with a huge infusion of dollars. Now, will park visitors see any differences on the ground yet, or will some of these dollars be redirected to deal with these, you know, flood damages?
Well, they will. Some of it is going to be much more longer term, candidly, most of that. But let me back up a second and acknowledge, you know, the legislature did really two very important things for state parks. One was the passage of HB 158, which served to dedicate 94% of what's called the sporting goods portion of the sales tax to go to state park funding. And that's critically important, not only because of the size of that funding, but really because for the first time, it gives us some modicum of predictability. We can actually plan into the future what we want to accomplish with respect to building and construction and operations and programs of our state parks. We also have funding to support our local park program, which is immensely important. So that was huge. The second thing that the legislature did, which was so valuable, was to provide this large infusion funding from the sporting goods portion of sales tax to help address our deferred maintenance needs. And we've had accumulated a multi-decade backlog of hundreds of millions of dollars of deferred maintenance in the system that has to be addressed. A lot of that is underground. It's water and wastewater and utility systems that are critical for the health and safety and operation of our park. And so those are priorities that we're going to address immediately. Things not necessarily that visitors see, but we can't have the parks open. They're not safe if those aren't operating functionally and safely. But there are other improvements that visitors will see, from renovation of the CCC era rooms at Balmoray to the renovation of dozens of bathrooms around the state, to the enhancement of dining and rec halls in places. So visitors are going to be able to see that. Just a couple of weeks ago, we had a ribbon cutting for the refurbishment of the old CCC group use and recreation hall there at Lockhart State Park, which has been so important to families for generations who have come to that park. And so visitors are going to see things like that going forward, although a lot of it, at least initially, will be dealing with things that are underground. But what this funding stream is going to do in the future is give us the chance to start dressing up the facilities in the state parks and building new amenities and developing new parks. And most importantly, too, is getting ready for the centennial of our state park system, which is only 7 years away. And so we're excited about these developments.
That's awesome. Now, the legislature also funded some additional efforts to combat aquatic invasive species. Now, some folks listening in may not really understand what kind of issues these species cause. Can you explain why the department is so concerned and what people can do to help?
Well, the proliferation of these exotic species, and in particular these aquatic species, from giant salvinia and hydrilla and water hyacinth to exotic organisms like zebra mussels, are having a profound impact on the waters of our state. And not only do they displace native species and disrupt the habitat conditions and water quality, but they can also, if not managed and controlled, literally take over lakes. And, you know, that's happening at places like Caddo Lake and Sam Rayburn and Toledo Bend, other critically important water bodies in our state. And these exotic species, if left unchecked, cause hundreds of millions of dollars of damage to those reservoirs. They disrupt water supplies. They diminish property values around those lakes. They preclude water from being able to be moved from place to place. They impede water input systems for plants and industrial facilities and marinas. So it's a very significant economic concern for the state as a whole. And the legislature, thankfully, recognize the importance of the department having growing funding to work with communities and river authorities and nonprofits to help try to arrest the spread of these exotic organisms from lakes to other lakes. And we're accomplishing that through a couple of things. One, we are building upon a very successful boater and angler education awareness campaign that advises those boaters to clean and drain and dry their boats before moving them from one lake to another. That's a very simple thing that we can all do to stop the spread of these exotic plants and organisms. And then secondly, we're using the funding to partner with river authorities and nonprofits and communities and our own staff to treat infested areas to, again, to help control the spread and the proliferation of these very pernicious and exotic species.
Okay. Now, later on this summer, the next group of Texas game wardens will be graduating from the Game Warden Training Center and will, as always, hit the ground running. Now, I know there's been more emphasis on wardens being involved in homeland security and other issues. Will this group of wardens be focused on the border?
Well, it's important to recognize that we've worked on the border with our team of game wardens since the agency's inception. And obviously, we focused on our primary responsibilities of water safety and fish and wildlife violations and catching poachers and trespassers. But as most folks know or may not know, our game wardens and our park police officers are commissioned to enforce every single law in the state of Texas. Starting in 2014, we were asked to play a much more elevated role in helping to address the preponderance of both drug smuggling and human smuggling that was going on in deep South Texas at the border. And so our game wardens, because of their capacity, their expertise, their knowledge of the rivers and ranches and refuges and bays, are able to work off the pavement in ways that most other law enforcement agencies can't. And so I've been very proud of that their efforts. The class of cadets that are going through the academy right now, there are 19 or 20 of them that will be assigned to areas with a very strong border nexus, which will help to, again, just amplify our presence along the border. And our game wardens will do their traditional law enforcement work, but their presence will serve as a force multiplier, and they'll be there to help serve in periodic surges to address problems as they ensue, working closely with local, state, and federal law enforcement authorities.
Okay. Now, there's always been a spotlight on our game wardens, on Texas game wardens, but I understand that now there's going to be a national spotlight in the means of a program called Lone Star Law. What can you tell us about that?
Well, we couldn't be more excited about this. We have had entreaties for years from producers and TV shows that wanted to do stories and shows about our game wardens. And to be fair, we've resisted that. But we met a group of producers that we felt comfortable could tell the proud story and stories of the work of our men and women that wear the blue badge representing the state as Parks and Wildlife game wardens. The show called Lone Star Law is going to come out this summer. I've had a chance to see the premiere, and it is terrific. People all across our state and country are going to see the extraordinary work and depth of responsibilities that our game wardens have. Again, not just in their traditional responsibilities of fish and game enforcement, water safety and boater safety, but also emergency response and disaster relief and all of the other law enforcement related situations that they're called in to do every single day across our state in every single county. And people will see that show, and it'll make them proud of their state game wardens.
Well, that's cool. I'm looking forward to seeing it. Now, I know you're a big-time dove hunter, and that September 1 is a red-letter day on your calendar. And I understand that this year will be the longest dove season in decades. Can you explain what that's about?
Well, we couldn't be more excited about it. I, you know, grew up September 1st is like a national holiday with the opening day dove season. And our biologists work very closely with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to set dove seasons around the state. And historically, we have been limited to a 70-day dove season. And depending upon where you are in the state, we split those days up into two zones or two kind of seasons, the early season starting in September and then a later season in December. But we've been limited by a time frame of 70 days. Thanks to the work of our wildlife biologists and particularly our migratory game bird team, they were able to work with what's known as the Central Flyway Council and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to convince them that Texas could sustain a 90-day dove season. And so for the first time ever, Texas dove hunters are going to have an extra 20 days to hunt their favorite quarry across the state, and I hope to be out with them for as many of those as possible.
Thanks, Carter. Now, the upcoming deer season is also right around the corner, and kind of on a down note, of course, chronic wasting disease has been in the headlines in recent months. I know you spent a lot of time dealing with that. Can you update us on what's happening on that front?
Well, chronic wasting disease is a serious issue. It is basically the deer equivalent of what is known as BSE, or mad cow disease. It's a fatal neurological disease in deer, and it has significant implications for hunters and hunting and wildlife and landowners and property values and rural communities. And the last thing that we ever wanted was the entry of chronic wasting disease into our state. Regrettably, we discovered it in free-ranging deer on the New Mexico border out in the Waco Mountains just east of El Paso. But since the summer of 2015, regrettably, we have discovered it in several other places in our state. We found it in 4 captive deer breeding facilities, 3 in Medina County, 1 in Lavaca County. And then we discovered a free-range mule deer that had CWD up in the panhandle south of Dalhart. So we have been working with a wide range of stakeholders in the ranching and wildlife and deer breeding and veterinary and biological and hunting communities to try to devise some science-based, reasonable, pragmatic strategies to allow us to help localize and contain the spread of chronic wasting disease to the extent practicable and to the extent that we can. And so we have heightened our surveillance and testing of deer both on a free-range basis and in captive breeding facilities. I'm very proud of the fact that we have integrated pioneering new techniques in live animal testing, working with our partners in the Animal Health Commission and the breeding community, the first state in the country to adopt these kind of new procedures to help enhance our testing regime for deer in pens. And live animal testing is come on to the scene here, and that's an exciting new development that I think offers us a lot of promise in our disease surveillance and management. And then we're in the throes right now of considering new rules governing disease testing of live deer movements. And so we're having a lot of input from stakeholders across our state on that, and we're going to continue to manage this in a smart and an adaptive way with the ultimate goal to help protect the health and vitality of all of our deer, both in free-range situations and in captive facilities across the state.
Is there anything hunters should be aware of for this upcoming season of what they should do or how they can help?
Well, we always advise hunters to be aware of any special local regulations where they hunt. And we have established some areas of the state in which there are mandatory zones that deer need to be tested if they're harvested in those particular areas. And so we want hunters to be aware of that. Also, in our efforts just to help heighten our surveillance of the disease across the state to see if it exists in places. We've established checkpoints in areas. Our biologists have been out collecting samples over the last year. You know, we collected well over 10,000 samples across the state thanks to the support from hunters and landowners. And so we just ask hunters to be advertent to those kind of things. And as we have always said, if a hunter takes an animal that appears to be obviously sick or gaunt or emaciated, we strongly discourage them from consuming that meat. We ask them to call our game wardens or wildlife biologists to let them know so that they don't inadvertently run afoul of things, and we can help them deal with that situation.
Now, as we close out this interview, let's shift gears just a little bit. As you well know, Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation is about halfway through Keeping It Wild, the campaign for Texas. This fundraising effort is aiming to raise $125 million for critical conservation projects. In early June, a major announcement was made about a $1 million artificial reef project. Can you fill us in on any of the details about that?
Well, we couldn't be more excited about the construction and enhancement of this artificial reef, really, in Texas waters. It builds on a long-standing partnership that we've had with the Coastal Conservation Association, who's helped us in so many ways, from marine conservation and fisheries management to habitat enhancement all across the state. And so this is a natural outgrowth of that long-standing partnership. This nearshore reef, which again is going to be in Texas waters, roughly 6 or 7 miles offshore from Port O'Connor, is going to be almost 400 acres in size, twice as big as any other reef that we've had a chance to construct in the past. The reef is going to provide critically important habitat for fish that will be attracted to its structure and features. We know that it'll provide important spawning grounds for reef fish, you know, such as red snapper. The angling opportunities here are going to be immense, and so too will the diving opportunities. And so we're excited about being able to help build and enhance habitat in these nearshore waters that anglers and divers and other boating enthusiasts are going to enjoy for generations to come. And we look forward to building on this in the future with our partners at the Parks and Wildlife Foundation and CCA.
Yeah, this is really another great example of a public-private partnership, very similar to Powderhorn Ranch.
It's the way we get things done. These public-private partnerships are great examples of leverage and growing the pie, so to speak. And the results, like the reef, like Powderhorn Ranch, so many other things, just speak for themselves.
Thank you for being with us today, Carter, and for being our very first podcast interview. I'm sure we'll be talking to you again.
Thanks for caring about our wild things and wild places. They need you now more than ever.
Until next time, thanks for listening to the Texas Parks and Wildlife Podcast.
Texas Parks and Wildlife Podcast is brought to you by Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation, supporting high-impact conservation projects across the state. Find out how you can help at tpwf.org.